Mr. Innes, Reel 7. What date did the sinking take place?
It was the 11th of March at 1 minute past 8 at night.
And what happened to you next? You mentioned the inquiry.
Yes. Now, whether on account of me being close in the vicinity of the explosion and the experience I'd been through, I was one of the fortunates that was sent home. The rest of the men off the ship were drafted onto other ships. They didn't get sent home. I did with another chap. I forget his name, but his father was chief engineer of Burton, where the big brewery is. Burton-on-Trent, is it? His father was chief engineer there. I forget his name. The two of us were sent home. And we came down part of the way on the Valiant, which had just been raised. It had been sunk by these Italian some fellas, you know, with the bombs. So they lifted her and they put me on there to steam her down to Alexandria. We're in Alexandria, then we went down through the canal down to Durban, where I left the ship. She went into dry dock there, and I went into a transit camp there. I was there for about 2 weeks, and we moved from there. I think I was on some ship, I forget the name of it now, down to Cape Town, and went to another transit camp there for 2 weeks, and we came home on the Duchess of Atholl. And from there, went into barracks in Portsmouth, and I was drafted into combined operations.
You mentioned that that gentleman that you lost touch with on the boat.
Davies, leading stoker Davies.
Did you find out what happened to him?
I did find out, and strangely enough, this was only 2 years ago. 2 years ago. And I get the Navy news, and in there, as readers request one thing or another, he's a stoker ring asking if anybody knew the whereabouts of the next of kin of leading stoker Davies. Now, I didn't know leading stoker ring. Apparently he was on the Nyad, but because you don't know names, you know, there's that many, there's 600 there. And I thought, well, I'll ring him up. That's leading stoker Davies. It must be the fellow that gave me a hand. If it hadn't been for him, I mightn't be here today. When you're in a situation lying there, why, with a man lying on the floor, what do? Do you leave him? Go and save your own life? Or do you go with him? What do? It's an awkward position. That's happened. We were stokers. Stephen Stoker Davis saved our lives. I put it that way. Or both our lives. So I rang the phone up. I said, what's this about leading stoker Davis? He says, oh, well, I want to tell them what actually happened. I said, well, I thought he went down with a ship. Oh, no, didn't go down with a ship. I said, well, that's news to me. I said, well, what happened? He says, well, I was picked up by the destroyer Lively. I said, I was picked up with a Lively. But I was carried down below. I had hypothermia. I couldn't move. I had to be lifted up. And I didn't know what was happening on the deck. He said, well, I was on the deck. He said, I was all right. I was on the deck and we were helping to pull the survivors up onto the destroyer. Leading stoker Davies is in the water, and he'd brought some men alongside. He picked them up, you know, in difficulties, and took them alongside, and the rest of the sailors were taking them off him and hauling them up the ship's side. So he'd brought two alongside, and he says, I was on the deck and I was shouting to them along with others. I said, right, you've done your whack, come on board now. You'll be exhausting yourself. You've done your work. Come on board now. He says, no, I'll go and get one more. See if I can find one more. They said, no, come on board now. At any rate, they talked him over. He came on board, and he stood on the deck a bit, and he said to Ring, he said, I don't feel too well. He said, well, go down below. There'll be a sick bit tiffy down there. He'll look after you. And he says he went down below and died. That's unbelievable, this. Probably had oil fuel, a lot of oil fuel about. But why should he wait 60 years to bring this story out? I just can't understand this. Can you? The next of kin. There'd be 110 at that time, wouldn't there? His parents. Man, this leading stoker ring. You'd be about 26 there.
Did you, in your account of the inquiry, did you mention that this chap had saved you?
No. No. They were just concerned, you know, about the door. I probably mentioned that I got a hand. Well, I must have. I would have mentioned it. That's true, yes.
I was just wondering in the sense that, was he, you know, might he have been awarded?
He should have had a medal as big as a dustbin lid for what he did. He saved my life, the other chap's life, definitely his life. I might have decided to leave him. And the people he pulled out of the water, two, he took another two alongside. But there must be thousands of cases like this. They're never recorded, they're never known. They just disappear.
Can we go back to when you were in the water? You weren't on a boat, you were floating in the water.
Yes.
How long were you in?
I reckon about an hour to an hour and a half.
And what were the conditions of the sea? You've mentioned calm. Oil. You've mentioned oil in that being around.
There was oil and stuff about, but it was calm. There was no waves or nothing, you know, it was calm.
You'd have to be very careful you didn't swallow oil.
That's right. Now, another thing, when you join the Navy, you go through all kinds of courses. And one of the courses, which I took in very well, was about when a ship sinks. It said, never attempt to board a Carly float. Never attempt to board a Carly. Well, these are the things that throw off, you know. Always keep near them, but never board them. He says, because there's trouble. There's people there struggling to get on. And I heard stories where people were hit on the head and they probably lost their lives fighting to get on these things. So I took that advice and I kept near one. And I saw quite a lot of carry-on going on and struggling to get on and, see, and hit them on the head and all this, with the oar and all this. You know, terrible, really. But that was good advice. And another thing they said, never go off the low side of a ship. Always abandon it from the high side, which makes sense because it'll roll over on top of you, see. Because a lot of them, when the list was on, they got ripped to pieces with the barnacles on the bottom sliding down the high side. But when we left, she was... Even Kay was ready to go. She went stern first, flooding through that after door, you see. Proved conclusive that door, for as much as they said it was collapse of bulkheads, they must have known. But they probably wanted to clear the commander out on him. What he probably did, he might have shut the door, but somebody come through. Now, another interesting thing about that, there was another lad, Allison. He's been here once or twice. He died about, I think it was about 18 months ago. He was in that washroom. I said to him, how do you get out of there? He must have got out before us, you see. He says the bulkhead between our washroom and the senior rates, the chief POs, he says that was blown down with the force of the explosion. So he says, I went through there, into their wash place and out their door. I thought, oh, yeah. That must have been why we were unconscious lying on the floor. I never heard anything. We didn't know that bulkhead was down. It was pitch black.
You were obviously in the water. You weren't unconscious.
Fully conscious.
Is there a sense of fear when that happens to you?
No, I felt quite normal. You know, I'm all right. I'm buoyant, I had my life jacket on.
They work very well, the life jackets.
Oh, yes. They're just like a rubber tyre which you blow up, you know.
And you'd be well aware, of course, that there were other ships around you to
That's right. And I was close to the Carly float, you know, keep near that, you know, which I had been told to do. Keep near them, never board them. Good advice.
Although it's the Mediterranean... After an hour or so in the water, were you getting cold?
Yes. Well, I couldn't move my hands or legs. I'm a bit of a hothouse plant myself. I like heat, and whether I'm easily affected, I don't know. As this was March, you know, the weather, it's not very cold in the Med, is it? Probably 60, but it was enough to chill me, unless it was nerves or some other reaction, maybe, yeah.
You say you were lifted out of the water.
Yeah.
How was that done? How did they get you out?
Two men in the boat because the destroyers are fairly low, and these fellas on those men on the side of the ship on the scramble nets, they lifted me up, and they carried me down below, and they poured warm water over us to get me circulation going. I remember that.
And you say you were cut in your hands, were your legs were cut. You had cuts on
feet. Them. Feet were cut, and cuts on my head, and other than that, all right.
Is there a reaction? I mean, you get picked out of the water. You're safe, in effect. Is there a physical reaction after that?
Not in my case. I cannot recall. I always seem to be calm. Because this Jerry Fuster, he was talking to this other chap that stopped in. His son's in the Navy now. Jerry had been talking to him. He says, you know, Joe, I was known as Smokey Joe in the Navy. And he says, you know, he was so calm. He didn't seem to be bothered. So.
On getting ashore, where did they put you?
I went into this, the Royal Naval Air Station at Decatur, just outside Alexandria. It was a canvas camp, or under canvas.
And was that a medical centre?
I don't think so. No, I think it was an air base which they'd put a few extra tents up to take survivors.
So you didn't need any serious medical attention as such?
No.
And as survivors, what kind of... Obviously, they would look after you.
When we're on the destroyer, they give us a blanket. You wrap it around it, because you've got a boiler suit on, it's all thick oil. That was dumped. I was given this blanket, and that's all we had to go ashore in. And as you used to say about the spies in Alex, trying to keep a secret there, they said, try and make on the ship's not lost. So they put the Cleopatra to lead in as though it was the Naiad, because the same class ships. So they think, oh, well, the Naiad hasn't been lost, it's there. So, but the gippos would know exactly, you know, what was happening. And I went there, and we got to survivor's kit, which was trousers and underpants and stuff, and it was donated by the Canadian Red Cross. And later on, we got proper equipment.
And then you said that you were sent home.
That's right.
You didn't stay. This would be what, survivor's leave or something of that
yes,
nature?
Then I was.
So can we just enlarge a little bit on your journey? You said you went aboard the Vanguard, was it?
The Valiant.
The Valiant, that's right, which had been hit by these small submarines and been raised again.
Italian, what do they call these?
And did you have an engineering task to perform on that ship whilst
you
were on it?
Yeah. I was dynamo area there. I looked after all the electrical equipment, dynamo. There was four steam turbo generators and two diesels. Because a funny thing happened there. I went down below one day to the diesel set, and the leading stoker down there, trying to be helpful, had started the diesel set up. And as I was going down below, I could smell something burning. I said, what the hell's happening? He gets down there, and he'd started the setup without turning the cooling water on. The result was the thing was red hot. And it was a Blumenvoss diesel set. I think it was Blumenvoss, German make. It was blue. This thing was a bronze casting. It was blue with the heat. I thought, my God. And I stopped it, like. I said, what the hell is it? He said, well, I thought I'd start. I don't know. I said, well, you haven't turned the water on. So I said, well, better wait a bit, because I'll get into trouble. The machines have got to be started on set times, you know. I thought, well, lucky to get away with this. And then I put the water on straight away, and it cracked something. So anyway, after a while, I put a bit of water on and gradually got it going. But anyway, the whole casting is blue with the heat, you know. And I only was on that ship till we got down to Durban. Now, what that leading stoker could see, if anybody queried that, they'd say, hey, look at the state of this, what's going on? The last day our air came aboard here and stuff. Because he said to me, he says, are you going to put me on the charge for starting it up? I said, no, forget it. I could have had him disrated, you know, the leading stoker for doing that. Not supposed
is
to
there
do.
Differences in life aboard a big ship like that and the destroyer?
Yes.
A cruiser?
Well, not so much. They're both classed as highly regimented. Everything works according to the book. You know, like on destroyers, like as Mac would tell you. Doors were left open in action and all this. None of that on crew. Everything just sailed up tight. But destroyers seem to be fairly lax.
And again, it was strict discipline on the Valiant as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And when we went through the canal, everybody on deck, bar those required to run the ship, as the Germans used to mine the canal at night, they usually used to stretch nets across it, and any holes where the mines were. But they still took precautions, and everybody up on deck till you got through. Another funny thing there, which seems strange to me, when we get through the Med, we're crossing the line, across the international date line, the equator. They carried out the King Solomon, King Canute coming aboard, King Neptune, Father Neptune comes aboard. And they stopped the ship, to let them get aboard. Then they start up again and they do the usual routine, anyway, that hasn't crossed the line. But I thought, this is wartime, what if there's a sub sitting out there? But they got away with it.
And you went to Durban, as you said.
That's right, yeah.
And into a transit camp.
Yeah.
Were you there long?
I think we were there about 3 weeks. And I think about the same amount in the Cape Town transit camp. About 3 weeks.
Were these regimented places, did they?
They were fairly lax and they were mixed. I know I went ashore in... I think it was in Cape Town. Was it Cape Town? I think it was Cape Town. And I'd had something to drink, I don't know, because there was the Boer element there. If you went into one of their pubs, they didn't like the British, and fellas used to say, I want to stay clear of them, they dope your drink. Well, whether they did mine, I don't know. But anyway, I got to the station, all right, then I collapsed. And two RAF blokes carried me aboard the train, laid me in the corridor, and carried me through the guard on the camp gate. I told them which tent I was in, like, and dumped me in there. So they were very good of them, otherwise I wouldn't have got back. And I was off my food. I couldn't even drink water. I was ill, What had happened, I don't know. But it was a fairly loose-run camp. I mean, normally they wouldn't have allowed us through. There was somebody carrying somebody through. But I got away with it. I think it was the base of the Muizenberg Mountains. And another funny thing happened there. This chap from Burton-on-Trent came home with me. We'll go ashore. I said, we'll go to other pictures. So we went ashore down into Cape Town, and we're going along this street, and this big car pulls up, Rolls Royce. This old gentleman sitting in the back. The car stopped, and he put the window down. He said, are you two gentlemen doing anything tonight? And we said, you think we're going on a good thing, are you? So we said, no, we're going to go to the picture. He says, right, would you like to be my guests for the evening? I said, oh, yes. So he says, get in the car, and we'll go to this cafe. And he must have done this on a regular basis. We found out he did. Goes in the cafe. As soon as he came in the cafe, everybody's buzzing around, Anyway, goes, sits us down, orders a tea and everything. And he had a black chauffeur. So we'll have a tea, and then he says, right. He said, now I'm going to take you out of my place. Now he says, I want you to stop the night here. He says, you won't be able to stop in my house. But he says, I've got a little place where you can stop in there. And he says, in the morning, set your alarm. When you come out, he says, what I'd like you to do is go up on the roof of this building. There's ladders up the side, stairs up the side, and have a look round. He says, I'm considered to have the finest gardens in Cape Town. It's all right, I said, I'll do that. And he says, after you've seen that, go down the gate, get down the gate for 6:30, and the milkman will be waiting there for you, and he'll drive you back to the camp, see? So at any rate, that was the story we got first. And when we were driving back to his place, and we get to a little town, he says, well, what happens here? He says, my chauffeur lives here. So he says, I'll let him off here, and I'll drive the car up the hill. I thought, oh, that's interesting. It drives the car up the hill, and we're going over curbs and everything. He wasn't a very good driver. Anyway, when he gets up the top of this hill where he lived, it's the first time I'd ever seen this, pull in front of this garage doors, And he opened the doors from the car, standard thing now. Then we drove in this garage. Then the floor of the garage went down onto another level, and we drove through to his house. Huge place, as you can imagine. So goes in the house, and it's the only house I've ever been in. I've been in a few in South Africa, all white servants. Normally that's coloured servants, so he was a man of means, you see. So he says, right, and he got on talking. He said, well, I'll give you a tour around the house. I dumped in bedrooms and he took us around. There was radios in every room. We used switching these on, going around. Then we goes back and he said, well, the dinner's nearly ready. He says, now, I'll show you where this place is, where you're going to sleep. He says, there's everything there. It's a fully equipped house. There's telephones. He says, you can phone anywhere, do anything. It's at my expense. So, all right. So I'll explain. So I had the mail and a nice chat. And he says, would you mind signing the visitor's book? I signed the visitor's book. He says, you can look through it. And of course, there's dozens of names. He's doing this on a regular basis. And then he got on. He says, you'd probably like to know who I am. I said, oh, yeah. Well, before that, he says, would you like some money? I said, well, I don't bother money, you know. He says, you can pay it back, you know. I said, oh, no, we're all right. He said, all right. He said, if you want any money, tell me. So didn't want any money. So I said, well, you've signed the visitor's book. Now he says, you're interested to know, no doubt, who I am. So he said, I'm going to take you into a room. This was, he had a little, like a study room, went in there. And this room was covered with newspaper cuttings of his career. And he was Tommy Dockrell. He said, I'm known as Tommy Dockrell, the Justice of the Peace. And he says, I don't know whether he's a manager or president of the Canada Mutual Life Insurance Company. One of these big mutuals. He ran it in South Africa. That was his job. And it's Geordie's history from starting. Tommy Dockrell rides another £1 million winner and all these big cuttings out of the paper. Anyway, what happened next? I had the mail. What happened next?
And you went to the room that he put aside for you.
Went after the mail and had this talk and one thing and another. All that's happened next. He said, I'm going to give you a letter. Now he says, you take this letter wherever you are. He says, we have a branch. And he says, you take this letter to that branch, and if they do not give you or entertain you as I have entertained you here, let me know. The only trouble was, he only gave us one copy. The Burton man got it, and it was on there. And I always remember some of the words. It says, I, Tommy J.P., Dr. J.P., have had the pleasure of entertaining these two gentlemen. These two gentlemen are helping to keep Hitler off my doorstep. Signed, T.D. Dr. And he on about entertain them as well, I would, you know. But there was only the one. I often wonder if that fella ever used that. That was Tommy Dockrell.
So then you sailed from there and you came back home, you said?
That's right.
And was this ship sailing on its own?
Yes, unescorted.
It was a fast, obviously, yes. A fast vessel.
But on the next voyage it was lost. But everybody got off it. There was no loss of life.
Do you recall what date or time that you got home? You reached England?
No.
Weeks or months after you'd been torpedoed?
Trying to think. My memory's not good.
Well, when you got to England, you would get your leave, presumably.
That's right.
And how did your parents receive you after such a long time? And because they would have heard that you'd been torpedoed.
Yes. You? They knew the ship was lost, but they didn't know I was a survivor. You see, that was the problem. And rather funny, the house where we were living had been bombed. And had my photograph on that piano, and it was blown off the piano and ended up in the street with the glass unbroken. And my aunt, when mother told her, well, that picture was in the street and even the glass wasn't broken, she says, you've got nothing to worry about, he'll come back all right.
So they're obviously very glad to. The first intimation you were saved is when you walked through the door, and was that the situation?
Yeah.
That must have been quite a.
No, that's not true. I was writing letters. They knew I was a survivor, and the letters told them where I was and what was happening.
So there'd be a great relief and a
great
reunion.
Uh-huh.
How long was your leave that you were given?
I think it was about 2 weeks, and I went back to barracks.
Where was this?
Portsmouth. Then from Portsmouth, I was sent to join Combined Ops. And first of all, this is rumours again, we were told we were going to be trained as paratroops, you know, to drop in and fix power stations and all this stuff. Totally untrue. And we got up there and we were trained on diesels. Well, that served me time at Doxford, mainly on big, heavy diesels. And these were for the American LCILs, which apparently Lord Louis Mountbatten had some say in the design of these things. Anyway, the Americans took them up on a big scale, and they used them too.
Where was this? Where did you go to combine operations?
Troon.
In Scotland?
That's right. Where's it near? Can't think of this, isn't it? There's an island just off there. I forget the name of that island.
And was this a big camp?
Oh, yes. It had been specifically built for conscripts before the war. They started conscription. They knew war was imminent. And they built this, and it was a purpose-built camp, built in the form of a spider. The central hub was dining rooms, and the dormitories ran off, you know.
Were these all brick buildings?
Yes.
So they were quite comfortable, were they?
Oh, yes. All modern. Because when they first built them, you know, the big write-up in the press, luxury for troops, you know, tablecloths on the table and all this.
Who was in the camp? How was it made up?
There was all kinds there. There was RAF, Army, Navy. I know the Army personnel was getting near winter. It was cold, so it must have been around about Christmas time when we were up there.
What year would that be, do you think?
That would be the back end of 42, wouldn't it? Because these troops, they used to send them out with a blanket to sleep in the hills, you know. Terrible conditions.
So you had, in effect, commandos on there. And
that's right.
And so all in the same camp.
Yes.
And working in the hills and that around.
That's right. And using the beaches for land and craft work, you know.
And your role, you say, was to work on the diesels. This was for these landing ships infantry?
Infantry Large. Some photographs there I can show you.
And when you say working on the diesels, you were working on the diesels within the craft, or was it a workshop situation?
No, the idea was we were maintained. Motor mechanics ran them. They were crewed by motor mechanics and stokers and wiremen. Wiremen did the electrical work. Stokers did the watchkeeping, and the motor mechanic was in charge. And we were the maintenance. If any major breakdowns, we had to fix them. Okay.